Pals O' Mine. Here's a great book that my fellow hikers and outdoor enthusiasts will enjoy and appreciate. Nature Noir by Jordan Fisher Smith. Smith was a park ranger on the 48 miles of Sierra Nevada River Canyons, predominantly the American River Canyon, which I have hiked several times. So I obviously related to specific locations and historic references, but generally, park rangers around the country face similar challenging circumstances every day. But it's not just his stories and his memory, it's his writing. It's intelligent, eloquent, and poetic, and the details he remembers. Here's an example of great imagery. He discusses all the cases, the reports they have to write, and as it goes through the legal system, they don't always achieve the results aspired to, shall we say. He writes, quote, "Year after year, you wrote up these stories, and they'd wind up archived in a pile of cardboard boxes in the warehouse, flattening and drying like pressed flowers under the weight of all the stories above them. The stratigraphy of your career," end quote. Isn't that great? He writes of stones that have become orphans because mountains have washed out to the sea. He writes about the days and random events leading up to a flood in 1986, the gold rush disaster insofar as how it affected the land, working under a ridiculous, minuscule budget because the government assumed a dam would be built and everything would be underwater at some point anyway. There still isn't a dam, by the way. Investigating the scene of a mauling of a woman jogger by a mountain lion. At that time, no complete map of the myriad of trails in the canyon had been completed, so they only had a sketch map to work with. He wrote, quote, "It showed only a portion of the south wall of the Middle Fork, but the maze of paths on it looked like a plate of spaghetti tipped by a careless elbow onto a restaurant floor," end quote. As someone who has hiked the canyon numerous times, I can tell you that is exactly how they're laid out. He investigated illegal mining, illegal encampments, murders, drug overdoses, and tree poachers. A park ranger's job is obviously a dangerous one. In fact, he writes that according to a 2002 federal study, rangers are 15 times more likely to be killed on the job than agents of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Yeah. So next time you visit a park, please be sure to thank the rangers for their underappreciated efforts. Again, the book is Nature Noir by Jordan Fisher Smith. How do you keep a domestic violence perpetrator behind bars? Eric L. Nelson is a forensic and best practices criminologist and a former police officer and counterintelligence agent. He knows from personal experience and extensive research six steps that result in stronger convictions.
So did you read mystery novels when you were young?
You mean like the Hardy Boys?
Anything,
that's
yeah.
Dating me, huh? Because I remember when I waited for the next one to come out.
Okay.
But yeah, mystery novels for sure.
I had Nancy Drew because my mom liked Nancy Drew.
Yeah.
But I figured it out too quickly.
Yeah.
So I went to the library, went to the adult section, and got Mary Roberts Reinhardt, which was like really dark and very adult, but it fascinated me, and I was just hooked from there.
Yeah, right, it's a chance to train your brain away from school because you're trying, it's exactly what you're trying to figure it out in advance. You know, the great riddles of life, and when you're a child, that's the great riddle. Later, we have bigger problems we try to solve. There's always twists. A good writer's going to hit you with a twist here and there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The good ones know. So tell me how you started out in law enforcement, the field of law enforcement.
Yeah, okay, it's a good question. I became a reserve police officer in the city of Fillmore when I was 19 years old.
Oh, young.
Yes, back then you could become a police officer before the age of 21. I graduated from the academy when I was 20, but back then you could work on the streets while you're in the academy. So I actually hit the street for the first time as a 19-year-old. Fillmore PD doesn't exist anymore. It was taken over by the Ventura County Sheriff. So I was a reserve there for a while. Then I went on to be a reserve police officer at the city of San Fernando when I lived in that area. Then I later went to the city of Chula Vista in San Diego County. So you can kind of see a pattern. Wherever I'm living, I volunteer to be a police officer. Then later I became a full-time police officer in Stockton. Some people have heard of Stockton. It's had a few financial problems.
And
it's
criminal problems.
Famous also because Stockton and a couple of other cities in California compete every year to see which one has the most violent crime per capita. And several times Stockton has been number one. And I say that only because I actually loved working for Stockton PD. Got to do a lot of criminal investigations that many police officers don't see very often. It was not unusual once or twice a month to go to a murder scene. It was average for me to do between 1 and 3 domestic violence investigations in a 10-hour shift. And I probably did a rape investigation at least every month or two, but probably more often. It's a crazy city, that's what I'm trying to say. You don't get that many of those type of calls in a lot of places.
Yeah, that's higher than the average bear would investigate.
Yeah.
But how did you arrive in law enforcement to begin with at age 19? Was there anybody in the family that was in law enforcement? Or?
Well, I like the concept of sheepdogs. And some of my police officer friends and I, we think of ourselves as sheepdogs. For some reason that you can't necessarily explain, you're just one of the people that has it inside of you to be a protector of society. Not everybody in society is strong. Not everybody is courageous. Not everybody is analytical and can really, it's not apparent to them the crime that's in their area. It's not apparent to them that they're being taken for something. So the sheepdog is the big, strong, capable person who is analytical, who is curious, who is courageous, and just has a natural instinct to protect others. I think that describes a lot of police officers. I'm sure there's others who go in for other reasons, but for me, early on, my whole life, I've always helped people, and one good way to do that was either as a reserve or a regular police officer. I think also, even when I was in the Marine Corps, I had a conversation one time when I was in boot camp with one of my drill instructors. I'd already been a reserve police officer before I joined the Marines. And when we had this very conversation about sheepdogs, he said, well, I guess I'm a sheepdog of the world. And when you graduate, you will be too, because maybe that's what Marines do as well.
But how about as a kid? As you say, I think some of us are protectors of others, standing up for the underdog. Maybe because we ourselves, at some point, were in that position and we are trying to prevent or help others from being in that same position as well. Did you have any earlier childhood memories, maybe, of being personally involved or maybe witnessing something?
You're perceptive. Very good. As a child, on 3 different occasions, I was a victim of bullies, gangs of bullies, doing different things that I don't really care to go into the details. But even though I'm big and strong, and for people who can't see me, I'm 6'4", 230, and I'm very, very strong, and I'm fast. When you're a child, you're not necessarily that way. And so I can relate to people who aren't strong or aren't able to protect themselves, either as children or adults. I can remember a time when I was small and powerless to stop, on 3 different occasions, gangs of bullies doing some pretty serious, you know, criminal type things. So I think, yeah, that may have helped to shape my desire later on to protect people from having bad things done to them when possible.
So how old were you when you decided to pursue it in an educational field?
Education has been an interesting mix for me. First of all, to the best of my recollection, I graduated number 6 from the bottom. In high school, I went on somehow to junior college. And I think that's probably because the state of California and the California Community College system is set up to help people have another chance if they didn't do well in high school. You can go to the community college and start over, if you will. You couldn't get into California State University, you couldn't get into the University of California, but you can go to California Community College. And so that's where I went. But it wasn't working for me. And I was very fortunate to have a professor early on. His name was Mitch Smith, taught at Moorpark College. And he sat me down and said, I think that this would help you. And he helped me make flashcards, but he also helped me to understand you're the type of person that needs to repeat things over and over and over, and you have to take very good notes in class because you don't seem to pick up everything in class. But take all those notes and later go turn them into flashcards. Well, that changed my life. It worked. It actually turned out to be probably the single best study strategy that allowed me to now go on and earn 6 university degrees. Among those would be 3 master's degrees, and then I was fortunate to just earn a PhD from the University of California at Davis. So
What do you mean fortunate? It's not like you win the lottery.
It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. Well, but I also should say fortunate because I had a series of fellowships which paid my tuition entirely.
Okay, gotcha.
And so I am grateful to the people of the state of California because you paid for my PhD. And that was probably both the cost of tuition, other expenses, and I also received a fairly comfortable stipend. People of California easily put $150,000 or more into my PhD.
Well, clearly it was a good investment on our part.
Well, I am trying to give back to the state in a lot of different ways. I never forget how grateful I need to be.
I will speak on behalf of the entire state of California and say that we are appreciative.
Well, wonderful.
And I appreciate your sitting down and taking this time with me and my listeners to
absolutely
talk about domestic violence from a law enforcement perspective, which isn't covered a lot in the news. It's the NFL players, of course, and right, which it's easy to segue into soldiers who have, I think, a very similar perspective. When you're trained, it's browbeat into you, that violence, and it's hard to just leave it at the gate when you go home. But approaching it from, I'm not condoning it, obviously.
No, of course
I
not.
I can understand how it could go that direction.
Well, in law enforcement, on the one hand, you do become desensitized to violence because you see it all the time. I've seen dead babies. I've seen plenty of dead adolescents and teenagers. I've had to pull people out of cars, helping the EMTs and the firefighters, of course. They actually do it, but I've been there. I've watched people die in an ambulance. So, on the one hand, as a police officer, you have to become desensitized because you cannot afford the luxury of an emotional reaction when people are counting on you to have instantaneous reactions to keep yourself and bystanders and victims and children safe. So, of course, that then leads people to think you're
cold,
not human. They don't see police officers gathered in a circle at 3 o'clock in the morning, because you all just got off at 3 a.m., and you're sitting around in a circle drinking a beer and talking about all the terrible things you saw that night. And that's one cathartic way to get some of it out so that you can maybe go home and go to sleep. So there is a very human side to it. You can't show it to the public. Not because you are trying to be somebody. You have to be non-emotional. You have to be rational because everybody's counting on you to make that split-second decision that saves someone's life. Having said that, domestic violence is a highly emotional event to participate in as a police officer and to witness because you're there to solve problems. You're there to, because quite often you get there, I say participate in, it's going on. You get there, and a block away, you hear the yelling, or you hear the children crying, or you hear the door slamming, or you see a car tearing out of a parking lot. And so you get there, and I guess participate. You're the participant, the unexpected participant, who steps in and takes control, and you have to be the adult on the scene. And you have a lot of things to think about at the same time. But having said that, I do want to say a little bit about how police officers get trained to respond to domestic violence, because that really goes to the heart of my academic work.
Well, it seems to me it's like you're stepping into a dogfight, which generally is not
sure
always a healthy thing to
do. I mean,
to do.
The police officer part of you comes in, you and your friends, because you never go in alone. You control the situation. You check everybody for weapons. You sit them down. That's the safety part. It's done. Now you have to start dealing with the legalities of an investigation, what are you going to do with the children, and so forth. Police officers don't show up on the scene and just kind of make up what they're going to do. This is something that you've received in the police academy, dozens of hours of training, including role-playing. Then you're in supervised field training, one-on-one with a training officer in the car for 6 to 9 months. And so you do a number of these investigations under the microscope of a field training officer watching you and teaching you. So I don't want to make it sound like police officers don't know what to do. But interestingly and amazingly, of the dozen different things a police officer could do to investigate domestic violence, most of them are optional. In other words, you're not required to do them. You're not required in the state of California to make an arrest. That surprises people. 38 states, but not California, 38 states require an arrest, but not California. Arrest is advised. So you don't have to make an arrest. You don't have to get an emergency protective order. What is that? A police officer can call the on-duty judge, tell the judge the facts of the case, and say, Your Honor, I would like to request that I get a move-out order that the wife, the husband, whoever is responsible this particular time, move them out for 10 days, no contact, children to go to the other party. You know, I mean, you tell the judge what you hope to get. The judge then tells you what you get. But most of the time, they give you what you ask for. By the time you go and serve that on the suspect and type it in the computer, that can take you an hour. You're not required to do that. Now, you may have a department that says, on our department, we require you. But it's not a legal requirement. You're not required to go knock on the door of neighbors and find witnesses. You're not required to interview the children who are present. You would think you would have to. You would think there'd be a law somewhere that would say you have to. But you actually don't. You're not required to take photographs. Maybe your department may say we take photographs, but there's no law that requires a police officer to take photographs, and so forth. That means, and this is kind of getting to the crux of what I've researched and published, what it means is a police officer can show up, and all they have to do is identify the victim. Because if you don't know the identity of the victim, you don't have a crime. So you identify the victim, you have to establish where this happened as best you can, what city, what county, what location. If you can, you try to identify who the suspect is, but you don't actually have to. And then you just make sure the person's safety and medical needs are taken care of. And that's it. All the rest is extra. So when we talk about the training and of police officers, we also have to talk about their customs. What I did in some of my research, and I published 5 articles last year that outline much of what I'm saying. In these 5 articles, I look at a lot of different things, but one of the things I look at is the habits of police officers when they're investigating. And as it turns out, I was able to identify 2 very distinct groups of police officers. One group of police officers routinely is pretty thorough in their investigation. By thorough, I mean they do a lot of the optional extra stuff they don't actually legally have to do. They get the emergency order. They knock on the doors of neighbors. They ask about past violence. They ask about concurrent crimes. What does that mean? A concurrent crime would be, okay, you have an act of domestic violence. It could be a slap, a kick. But that doesn't exist in a vacuum, because if you took the person's phone and threw it against the wall and broke it, you've got vandalism. If you did this in front of children, you have child endangerment. If you did it while you were driving the children, now you've got felony child endangerment. You can also find other things. For example, you interview the children. If you find out the suspect routinely is drunk in front of them, you can put on 273G, routinely drunk in front of children. So those would be some concurrent, or you know, the key scratch on the car, another vandalism. So you can find multiple concurrent crimes, and then you can also ask about what happened last week or 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, because you can find multiple incidents and you write these all up. That takes time, but this is the kind of stuff that actually causes prosecutions and convictions. The point I want to make is I identified one group of police officers that tend to do this kind of stuff. They get the EPOs, they find the witnesses, they spend an hour driving around to all the different places that the suspect might be to arrest her or him. They ask, where's the person's favorite bar? Where do their parents live? And you go to all those places and you try to find them. Well, you call them on the cell phone and talk them into coming into the station and surrendering. The other group of police officers tends to do the bare minimum. And not surprisingly, the officers that routinely do a lot of work, their investigations result in criminal charges about 270 times more often. Not surprising.
Now, you mentioned photos at the scene.
Yeah.
I immediately think of the old 1940s, 1930s, of the guy with the huge camera and the big flash going. So it's not new. So it's surprising to me that wouldn't be just a common standard issue, part of your uniform when you're going out with these calls. But obviously it's not, according to what you're saying.
Well, there's going to be some variables. If you work for a small department that doesn't have a lot of calls, most likely the police officer has a camera in the trunk and has plenty of time to take pictures. If you work in a city like I worked in, where 20, 30, 40 calls are stacked up, you've got a watch commander calling the sergeant saying, when are these officers going to get free? I need to start knocking down some of these calls. Well, you don't have to do the photos, or you could run in and take one picture of the injury and leave. But photos need to be a lot more than that. Particularly, let's say that the paramedics are going to show up and someone's got a gash on their head and there's blood all over their face. You want to take that picture beforehand, Because once the paramedics have cleaned them up, there may be a little red dot on their forehead and that's it. I took a picture like that. It happened to actually be a robbery case. I was the first witness called to the stand, and that was the first piece of evidence that the prosecutor presented, was the picture that I had snapped, actually with my own personal camera, moments before the paramedics got there and cleaned the guy up. So, you want pictures of not only the injuries, take pictures of the children. You want to document that children were present. Take pictures of the condition of the house. Take pictures of things that got broken. You want to take pictures of both the suspect and the victim. And I want to also explain, by the way, about 60% of the time, 40 to 60% of the time, both parties have been involved in mutual combat. So that's why sometimes you might really be talking about suspect. That does happen quite a bit. And the more recent research has really started to show that that's true. But having said that, you want to get photos of a lot more than just the injuries. Cell phones are a way to take a picture. You shouldn't use your cell phone, your personal cell phone, but in a pinch, you do what you got to do to collect evidence and email it to yourself or whatever. Photos are very important. Interesting, though, in my research, I found that, and now I'll start to put some numbers on it, if you take photos, you increase the chances of a prosecution by 60%. That's quite a bit. So if you take the 10 or 15 minutes required to do a set of photos, you've just increased significantly and substantially increased the chances that this case is actually going to get filed. The other option is it'll get rejected. Not going to go anywhere. People get a pass for what they did. Photographs also increase the chances of a conviction by 35%. Why is conviction important? Because a lot of the domestic violence research really just focuses on getting an arrest and whether or not the person gets jail time. There's so much more to a domestic violence investigation and prosecution and sentencing than just that. In one of my articles, of the five articles on my site, one of the articles just focuses on sentencing. And it all goes back to the better the job the police officer does, the more sentencing components a person gets. There's up to 16 different items the judge could give. Jail time, prison time, unannounced drug testing, mandatory attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous, mandatory anger management class, surrender your weapons. There's a whole different group of things. And typically someone's going to get supervised probation for 3 years. Well, if one person is found guilty gets 5 items, and another person found guilty or pleads guilty gets 9 items, just the count alone, the number of items that make up their individual sentence, that's one of the few things for which some evidence exists to suggest that pushes down rates of recidivism. What's recidivism? That's the fancy word that means they do it again. Because the whole goal is to stop the behavior. This stuff does not exist in a vacuum. There really was a domestic violence incident last week, and there really was one last month, and there could well be another one, but for how well you, the police officer, investigate this. You spend the time to do it right. You substantially increase the chances of prosecution. You substantially increase the chances of conviction. And you substantially increase the quantity of the sentence. And that may be the one thing that helps to push down the possibility that they're going to do it again. Of the 6 things that are optional that influence a case, I already went through photographs. Get photos, you increase the chances of prosecution by 60%, conviction by 35%. If you find more witnesses, for every single witness you find, the likelihood of prosecution goes up 68%. For every witness you find, the likelihood of conviction goes up 39%. If you take that 45 minutes that's needed to get an emergency protective order, call the judge at home, you increase the rate, the prosecution likelihood by 87%. Now we're almost getting to doubling it. And the conviction rate doubles. It actually goes up 102% if you get an emergency protective order. So was that 45 minutes worth it? You're going to double the rates of prosecution and conviction. If you make an arrest, you increase the likelihood that the DA, the prosecutor, will take the case and prosecute it 94%. If you make an arrest, you increase the likelihood of conviction by 78%. Here's the big one. For every additional crime that you identify and describe in your report. So I was talking about those concurrent crimes, the vandalism, breaking the person's phone, criminal threats, also the previous but still chargeable crime, the DV last week, last month, those are all still chargeable. For each additional one that you list, you increase the chances of prosecution by 284%. You almost triple the likelihood that that person will be prosecuted just by listing one extra crime. And for each one after that, it's another 284%. And by the time you've listed four or more, 100% chance it will be filed. And conviction rate goes up by 142%. So that's five of them. There's one more optional thing. And this one is how quickly you complete your investigation and turn it in so that your department can take it over to the prosecutor's office. Now you might think, oh, all investigations get done the same day, and that's just not true. Because again, if you're a minimalist, you show up, you identify your victim, you make sure the scene's safe, make sure the bad guy's not around, you know, you write a basic report and you're out of there, well, that's going to have to go to detectives. They're going to have to find the bad guy and get a statement. They may the next day try to go get a protective order, and so on and so forth. They may come out the next day to get photographs, to do all the stuff you should have done. Maybe they'll do it and maybe they won't. The problem is, especially in the case of misdemeanor domestic violence, which is the less serious type of domestic violence, that's the slapping and the kicking. Felony would be the broken bones, someone needs surgery, someone needs sutures, someone needs crutches. That's felony domestic violence. The majority of domestic violence leaves no marks. It hurts the person inside. Misdemeanor domestic violence, the slaps and the kicks, the majority of those, they go to detectives and that's it. Nothing's ever going to happen. What I found is if you don't get it to the DA, the prosecutor, within 10 days, the likelihood of prosecution decreases by 25%. And if you don't get it to the prosecutor within 1 month, it decreases by 50%. So here's the other side of the coin. If you don't get a thorough investigation done, particularly on a misdemeanor domestic violence, it's dead in the water. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to get filed on. So the last of the six things is your sergeant's calling you. I need you to go back into service. I need you to take calls. Hey, Sarge, please, let me just finish. I need just one more hour. I mean, you have to bargain like that in a busy city, but it could make all the difference, especially when you think about what domestic violence does to children, because there's many different journal articles that have showed children who witness domestic violence, both male and female, are much more likely themselves to perpetuate domestic violence when they become adults. Little girls who witness domestic violence have a much greater chance of ending up homeless. And it just goes on and on and on. So part of breaking the cycle is using the resources of the court. Now, I didn't study this part of it in detail, but think about the mechanics of what happens after conviction. Almost everybody gets probation. Even felony domestic violence gets probation. One of my articles, read article number 4 on my site, it goes all through that. Well, what is probation? Probation means the judge sentenced you to, let's say, 90 or 180 days in jail, but they suspend the sentence, which means you can walk out and go back to your job. But if you screw up during the next 3 months, the next 3 years that you're on probation, if you screw up, there's no due process. Your probation officer grabs you and throws you in jail, and the sentence starts going. And then maybe after a few days, if you're lucky, you can get a hearing and try to convince the judge to let you back out. But a suspended sentence is just that. I think that's one of the reasons why probation is a little bit effective. People have this thing hanging over their head. If they're thinking about losing their temper, maybe they'll remember what they learned in anger management and they'll walk out because they can't afford to miss another day at work. They're going to lose their job and so forth.
I like that sentencing is not simply serving time behind bars. I agree. It sounds like I'm an expert, but just as a layman, I agree that if there's more aspects to the sentencing, then it will have a bigger impact. I could not see how it wouldn't. I was a volunteer youth crisis counselor in Ventura County at Interface, and we were always on call. Mm-hmm. Going out to homes, and there's just a lot of things that I learned when I was there. I want to talk about emergency protective orders because every once in a while we will hear in the news that they just don't work. If someone is determined to go after that spouse, girlfriend, boyfriend, they're going to do it. There's no electrical barbed wire fence that's preventing them from crossing the line. How do you address something like that to people that are seriously afraid for their lives, not just a broken arm?
Well, ideally, when you get an emergency protective order, you have a suspect who is afraid of what will happen if they violate. Some suspects aren't. Some suspects are such control freaks that who the hell do you think you are to put that on me? I will show you. I will teach you not to do that. Research shows that their EPOs, emergency protective orders, are more effective with people who have a job, who have things to lose, tangible things to lose. Having said that, part of helping someone out of one of the worst type of situations, and many situations aren't, you know, life and death. But in a life and death situation, your EPO can also include an order that the defendant will make no attempt to locate the victim. The victim is given sole custody of their shared vehicle, etc. Then you do pull someone out of there in a bad situation. I'll tell you a story. Famous murder case in Stockton. I was the investigator who went to take the domestic violence report, and I ended up taking the victim down to a shelter, her and her kids, and she left, subsequently was murdered. What can you do? You're right, you can't make them stay. You can only pick them up and get the EPO. You can only take them to the shelter. You can only bring, in this case, I brought the women's center down, help her out. But you're right, there are people who go back into those situations. Having said that, the EPO is a very effective tool. I think it should be used to try to stop people who have something to lose from doing further.
Have you ever had a witness protection? They're not really witness, but in these kind of cases, maybe a witness protection in a case where a witness is actually afraid because they witnessed a domestic violence and maybe a member of the family or a neighbor even.
Well, you're asking the right questions because are people reluctant to talk and cooperate with the police? Sure, because they'll say to you, look, you're here for 5 minutes. You're gone. I got to stay here. You going to protect me then? Yeah, I haven't had to deal with witness protection. That's something more of a detective would deal with. My focus has always been more on patrol. I was a patrol officer. That was my primary focus. Focus of my research is what should patrol be doing? The officers who drive around in black and white cars, what should they be doing to make a difference in domestic violence? And that's where we have to overcome habits. Many of these officers are in the habit of, well, you know, I just do. So essentially what my concern is this. We have to change the habits of police officers. You could have departments who have a habit of doing minimal work. The California State Attorney General did a report on the status of domestic violence crime in the state of California. I have a copy of it. I've actually cited it heavily in several of my articles. The State Attorney General found that there is entire departments that do minimal work. And when the state attorney general interviewed local prosecutors, when they would get an iffy case that maybe if they send it back, more work can get done, it'll turn into a good case. A lot of times they'd say, which department did it? If it comes from a department that we know doesn't do good work, why bother to send it back? That's right there in the state attorney general's report. That's a culture of minimalism. How does that to recapitulate itself? Well, part of it's the fact that as a new officer, you want to fit in. You went to the academy and you learned how to be thorough in your domestic violence investigations. When you go through field training, because you have to go through a state-organized syllabus, you're thorough. Your field training officer makes you be thorough. But then the magic day happens. You go before the oral board and they pass you and you walk out. And your field training officer jumps in the car and leaves, and you get to take your own car out by yourself for the first time. And then when you keep being thorough, everybody's going to be like, now they're going to, you trying to be better than everybody? Whatever it takes, there's ways that cultures teach you. So there's actually research that's been published by the National Institute of Justice. There's several really good studies that have looked at entire police agencies and found, for example, in one agency that had about 4,500 officers, they found 8% of the officers produced 50% of the arrests. Believe me, the vast majority of every police agency is in a patrol car on the street. So that means the 60 or 70 or 80% of that agency that are in cars, and yet 8% and only 5% produce half the felonies. Cultures of minimalism. That's what the enemy is. Now there's other departments and there's individual police officers that by their very character and by their very culture, personal culture or culture of some departments, they do thorough work. That's why I said, okay, I have identified this best practices method for the investigation of domestic violence. The U.S. Department of Justice published it in December of 2013 in the FBI's Law Enforcement Bulletin. But how are we going to cause police agencies and individual police officers to start using it? They know the tools. No training is needed. People who say more training is needed are typically outsiders who don't know the police world. Believe me, before a police officer ever gets to go out in a police car by themselves, they've had to demonstrate repeatedly how to do a thorough investigation. And many of these same skills are used across a wide variety of crimes. Your camera, your witnesses. It's not that training is needed. Cultural change is needed. So I said, how are we going to do this? Because my research showed there's definitely a subset of police officers, a very sizable subset, that routinely do minimum work on domestic violence crime investigations. So I developed a method called P-Score. And the P-Score is pretty simple. You get a point if you get an EPO. You get a point if you identify witnesses. You get a point if you take photographs. And you get 1 point for each charge that you list. Because charges are, remember, 284%. You get 1 point for each charge. So you turn in your report and someone can literally sit there and say, okay, you found witnesses, you get a point. You got an EPO. Oh, you didn't get an EPO. Don't get that point. Didn't get photographs. Okay, you have a 2 point report. Whereas this other officer over here is consistently turning in 6 and 7 and 8 point reports. You can use my method to track officers over time. How is it, Officer Jones, your EPO rate is only 10%. I've looked at 10 of your reports. Your EPO rate is 10%. The departmental average is 60%. And some of the officers here have a 90% average. You know how to get EPOs. You had to do them before you even became a full police officer. I expect you to get your EPO rate up to 80% immediately. By the way, that's the kind of tough talk you get from sergeants. And that's the kind of tough talk, tough love, that's needed.
Let's address the children, protecting the children. When you mentioned taking photographs of them in the home, is that the expression on their faces, their attire, it's not a well-kept home? What exactly are you looking for? Maybe possibly injuries as well?
Well, the first reason you take photographs is so later, if you have to subpoena them for any reason, parents can say, my children weren't there. You may have talked to children, but they weren't my children.
So proof that they were present.
Proof that they were present. That's the first reason. Secondly, photographs tell things that don't necessarily make it into court, but they're important to know. Let's say you're investigating a very serious investigation. When you get there, the kids are playing Atari. Didn't even pay attention to it happening. That tells you a lot about that home.
A little too routine.
Or you have a child, and you can do video too. I used to actually do video. I had a body camera. I was the first one to have a body camera at Stockton PD. I understand they're now getting body cameras. I used to shoot video because you can see the kids crying. Or if you videotape them, you can hear them crying. Photographs also allow detectives and prosecutors later to look and maybe see something you might have missed that could be essential. I think photographs also serve to let both the victim and the suspect know this is really serious. You're not going to be able to backpedal from this later. We have witness statements, we have photographs, we have video, because as you might imagine, some suspects and some victims will later say nothing happened.
Well, and plus, parents have a tendency sometimes to just block out their children. They just become furniture at some point. And if they're shown a video or a photo of the result of their actions, how it's actually affecting or not affecting their children, that could be a big factor as well in future.
You make a good point. That's not something the police would do.
No, I'm just saying.
But you're making a very good point. The point you're making would be that the parents may become more aware of it when they actually watch a video and they adopt the perspective of a spectator.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a very potent thing that you're suggesting.
I imagine you have different scenarios because, as you were saying earlier, you're often arriving. You can hear it before you arrive, as you were saying earlier. Sometimes it's quiet by the time you get there. So you really do have to be prepared for any type of scenario insofar as not only a defensive arrest, voluntary arrest, absolutely refusal, to be arrested. And I don't think that the average person really understands, unless they watch a lot of CSI or TV cop shows, exactly what an officer has to deal with on a moment-to-moment basis.
Your first concern is for your safety and the safety of fellow officers. And your second concern is for the safety of any children if they're present, and then thirdly, the safety of the adults who are involved. So at first, you're not in investigation mode. You're just in let's keep everybody from being hurt mode. That's why you never go in alone. And if you need to, you just wait for as many officers as you need. Sure, you then go in, you make the scene safe, and you start to figure it out. An investigation can go a lot of different ways from that point. Who did what? Who's the suspect here? In what order am I going to get statements? There's an innumerable number of ways you could actually organize the investigation. Although we know the six things you need to do, for sure. There is a lot of danger in a domestic violence situation. I've come close one time to being very seriously injured in a domestic violence situation where I had a prolonged fight with someone who had a knife. Sometimes, not always, one of the parties is a control freak and they're just not going to have the police tell them what to do. Sometimes you have drugs or alcohol that is giving courage that's not appropriate and muting the little voice in their head that should be saying, knock it off. You'd be surprised how often you go to try to detain the violent individual, and all of a sudden the victim's now attacking you. So there's a lot of unusual things that can happen. A lot of police officers don't want to go to domestic violence calls. That's their least favorite call. After you've had a few times where you've really helped someone out, and the next day they're calling in a complaint on you, a made-up bogus complaint, because they want to try to undo the case. And the best way they can undo the case to keep their beloved one from getting prosecuted is to go after the officer. The police agencies are pretty good and they can figure this stuff out. But when that happens a couple times, it could make an officer say, why bother? I've been out there before. I've been out there again. This particular person has filed complaints against me when I helped her out or when I helped him out. Sometimes citizens don't think about their part in all of this. Helping the police. Citizens are our eyes and ears. You know, domestic violence came to the attention of the police a lot more when 911 systems were put in. Because now, really, for the first time, you could have, and cell phones also, you could have bystanders who don't know the people on a cell phone. Maybe they're walking by with their dog. On the cell phone, 911, they can call in and alert you to something you might not have otherwise found out about. That would be an example of people helping. Another tougher one is the citizen who's afraid of retaliation. There is no easy answer for that. I used to like to tell people, I'd come to the door, I'm not talking, I can't talk to you. All right, no problem, I'll leave right now, but I want you to memorize my phone number and call me. Here's my phone number. Repeat it back to me. Okay, I'm leaving now, everybody will see that I'm leaving, but I expect you to call me later and we'll talk about it. They have done that.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a good plan.
I mean, here's the funny thing. I've been in the worst neighborhoods and had lots of residents thank me for being there. And I think sometimes the public thinks in tough crime neighborhoods, the people hate police. I would say that's not true. I would say in tough neighborhoods, the majority of the people love the police. They appreciate the police, but they have to be kind of quiet and careful in telling you that because the thugs in the neighborhood have them intimidated. But on multiple occasions behind closed doors, I've had people in those areas tell me, we are so glad you're here. Please come by more often. I'd just like to suggest, if people listening to this want to do something, I'd suggest two things. Number one, read my 5 articles. If you're not going to read all 5, read the one that the FBI published. That's the easiest one to understand. And then, number two, print out the FBI article and send it to your local chief of police or send it to your local sheriff and ask them to think about considering asking their officers to use this best practices model. The key is going to be to write a very polite letter thanking them for the good work that they do to protect you and the community and ask them if they'd think about it. Because my suspicion is when a chief of police or a sheriff gets a copy of an article that was published by the FBI, they're going to read it. It's at least going to get their attention. And then it's hard to argue with the statistics. And they're going to all recognize these aren't difficult things. These are things we as police officers all know how to do, these 6 items. And so my prediction is as little intervention as printing it out and sending it to your chief of police might make a difference.
Eric's articles can be found at sites, SITES, .google.com/site/prosecuted domestic violence. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Maryland's Catoctin Mountain Park. The Maryland League for Crippled Children later renamed the League for People with Disabilities, moved to Camp Green Top in the park in 1938, one of the earliest camps in the nation designed specifically for people with disabilities. There are a plethora of hiking trails to choose from. In fact, the only access to the park's overlooks is by foot. You can visit waterfalls and a lake. Camp David is located within the park, but for obvious reasons, it isn't open to the public, and its location is not found on park maps. You can, however, visit the site of the first Job Corps Center and an old moonshine still. The county has quite a history with whiskey, including the Blue Blazes Whiskey Still. Isn't that a great name? Anyway, on a 1929 raid, the deputy sheriff was fatally wounded, and more than 25,000 gallons of mash were found in 13 vats of 2,000 gallons capacity each. Yeah, how's your brewing coming along? Hey, if you're on Twitter, check out hashtag bad scary stories. Pretty funny. Do something different. Instead of a birdhouse, make a bird fort.